Well, this story that came out of Mexico, just, you know, less than 100 miles from Douglas, Arizona, has just, the national press is trying to figure it out. The president has been tweeting about it. We here in the state of Utah, there are many ties in many of the articles. You'll see relatives who live here along the Wasatch Front, Harriman and elsewhere. We see names of those that were injured or killed that are actually familiar to many of us up here. And at the national press, Carol Makita, my friend and colleague for so many years, so we were just chatting about this. Sometimes for those of us that are kind of on the epicenter of many of these things, we have a hard time figuring it out. And I'll tell you, for the national press, they're just scratching their heads. But it's being reported in so many different ways. And I think it's appropriate maybe to start the conversation with this official reaction, is probably the best way to put it, from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Eric Hawkins, as a church spokesperson, who is saying, quote, "We are heartbroken to hear of the tragedy that has touched these lives in these families in Mexico. Though it is our understanding that they are not members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, our love, prayers, and sympathies are with them as they mourn and remember their loved ones." Carol, as we have talked about, this is kind of a murky environment we get in. And I had a bishop when I was a kid who was born in, quote-unquote, the Mormon colonies. Mm-hmm. That was the term that was used at the time, down in Mexico. I know when Mitt Romney was running for president, many that was brought up as well.
That was a subject.
Since his religion was certainly a free topic back then, several people mentioned that his father, mm-hmm. George Romney, had been born in Mexico. These folks have dual citizenship. What do we know about what unfolded down there?
We are learning more as the day unfolds. And I, for one, wondered when they were discussing in the first reports about mistaken identity of these cars. It didn't ring true to me. I wondered what in the world this could possibly be, this horrific tragedy. We certainly start with that. Our hearts go out to these families. But there were two attacks, an initial one in one car, and then the other two cars were attacked. So that kind of opens the door to, doesn't make sense that all three of them were attacked at one time. They were not. The families are members, many of them, of what's called Colonia LeBaron. We're familiar with the LeBaron family name here in Utah,
right.
Tied to fundamentalism, polygamists. The Langford family in La Mora, this very, very small hamlet, married into the LeBaron family. So that is the tie. They apparently have had problems over the years with the cartel. A number of times interacted in 2009, excuse me, Eric LeBaron, kidnapped for ransom. Community took a stand, said it would not pay for his release. He was released without a ransom, but months later, his brother Benjamin, who led the campaign, was beaten to death. His brother-in-law was killed. Then in 2010, Julian LeBaron published an article in the Dallas Morning News calling for Mexicans to stand up against organized crime.
Right.
And he said on told Mexican radio today that his family had received threats. He said, "We reported the threats, and now these are the consequences." Last year, the family also clashed with farmers in that area who accused the LeBarons of using excessive amounts of water to grow their walnut trees, leaving other farms nearby dry. So the Colonia LeBaron community has in the past demanded to be allowed to create its own security force, and apparently the Mexican government has not been happy about that request. So this is an ongoing story. Horrific as the news is that we are reporting, there's certainly a situation between the polygamous community and the cartels.
It has been portrayed in the national press that basically they were sandwiched between the rival cartel that mm-hmm. is trying to move in versus the cartel that they have had some abrasive situations with. And it was kind of almost portrayed that here are these innocent folks going along. And, you know, we used to have this term. And, you know, again, some terms are out of vogue right now. But remember when we were younger, if yes. somebody had a big family, they'd buy not a Suburban, they'd buy a Mormon assault vehicle. You know, that was the minivan
yeah.
and the big Suburban
the
SUVs, and so on.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Unfortunately, big Suburbans are associated with people who are in power, sometimes people who are in cartels or politicians,
correct.
Whatever it might be. So the image that the national press has left is that these folks were traveling in what looked like it could have been a cartel caravan, is the term that has been used. But if you really kind of understand the dynamics, there could be other scenarios.
I think that door is opening. Certainly the first scenario is a possibility, the mistaken identity. But the other is the fact that there were two separate attacks.
Right.
Does lend to more of a feud that has turned horrific.
And when we look at the terrible toll here, mm-hmm. and the latest information, and you may have something different, Carol, Carol Makita with us here at KSL News Radio. Six children were found alive. One child had a bullet wound, and one child was missing. But at least three women and six children, mm-hmm. all apparently U.S. citizens, were slaughtered by drug cartel gunmen mm-hmm. in northern Mexico. That is not disputed, but it's what caused this is raising some eyebrows, and especially those who have observed this situation for some time.
Mm-hmm. It is, and it is continuing to unfold, as you said, and we will learn more. But the family members who are here in the state of Utah and talking to the media are suggesting that there is something more to this,
right.
That there were problems that go back years.
I have some friends with the last name of LeBaron who
yes.
are very familiar with this. I need to put out some phone calls. But boy, this has gone all the way to the President of the United States who mm-hmm. tweeted out, and this is interesting, you know, President Trump said, a wonderful family and friends from Utah got caught between two vicious drug cartels who were shooting at each other, with the result being many great American people killed, including young children and some missing. If Mexico needs or requests help in cleaning out these monsters, this is a continuation of the tweet, the United States stands ready, willing, and able to get involved and do the job quickly and effectively. The great new president of Mexico has made this a big issue, but the cartels have become so large and powerful that you sometimes need an army to defeat an army. And the president of Mexico is kind of backpedaling a little bit from that, because I suspect he knows a little bit more mm-hmm. than, about this and the peculiarities that are in this region than does President Trump.
And maybe not anxious to have American forces en masse
right.
descend on an area in Mexico.
We are going to talk next, and Carol, I understand you too are going to talk with Christopher Blythe.
Yes.
And he is a part of the research faculty at the Neil A. Maxwell Institute at BYU. He has a lot of knowledge, a lot of expertise, and as a matter of fact, is working on a book that will be published by Oxford. It's amazing how many scholars from the LDS culture do publish through Oxford. It's quite remarkable. And we'll get some more. I'll look forward to your reports as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Doug, for having me. It's good to see you.
Oh, it's good to see you, too. A friend and colleague for so many years, Carol Makita, who also is working on this story. We will talk with Christopher Blythe coming up next here at KSL News Radio.
More afternoon news and in-depth coverage with Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
Boy, this is such a sad, sad story, and we're all trying to figure it out, and there certainly are very close ties to people right here in Utah, probably people that I know, as I mentioned. I have friends with the last name LeBaron, and we're all trying to understand what indeed did happen. This is, I think, of the three women and the six children that were slaughtered in this exchange, slaughtered by the drug cartel. Six children, thank heaven, were found alive. One child did have a bullet wound. One child is still missing. And there is all kinds of speculation as to what has unfolded here. And the bottom line is we just don't know. We thought it would be most interesting to talk with a research faculty member at the Neil A. Maxwell Institute at BYU, Christopher Blythe, who is on the line with us right now. Mr. Blythe, thank you for spending this time with us here on KSL.
Oh, thank you for having me, Doug.
Give us a little of your background. I was mentioning when we were chatting with Carol Makeda, whom you will chat with here before too long as well, you've spent a long time studying these fundamentalist communities that are offshoots of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. How did all of this come about for you?
I began interested in anthropology in college, and from there I started to visit different communities and correspond. And so for me, I've been at studying different communities outside of the LDS Church by different Latter-day Saint communities for the past 20 years.
It's interesting because there were many exoduses, as it were, at certain times in the history of Utah, at certain times in the history of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, where people, for various reasons, left and left the United States for Calgary, up in Canada and elsewhere, down in Mexico. I mentioned I had an LDS bishop when I was growing up who was born in the, we call them the colonies in Mexico. We talked about this when Mitt Romney was running for president of the United States, that his father, George Romney, was born in Mexico. Tell us a little bit more, especially about the Mexican, I'll use the colonies as the term down there, that we're familiar with.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we came, the Latter-day Saints came to Utah for religious freedom, right? We came here to avoid persecution and to build up a movement. And in 1852, we announced plural marriage, which was practiced by a percentage of the saints in Utah in the mid-19th century. And so prosecution amounted in the 1870s and the 1880s after the Edmonds Act. As a result, John Taylor decided that he wanted to set up colonies both in Canada and in Mexico. And so in Mexico, we had several major colonies set up by Latter-day Saints that wanted to another place where they could practice their religion unmolested.
As far as, how long has that gone on? When did that begin? And I assume it's still going on to this very moment.
Absolutely. So the 1880s is the start of these colonies. In 1910, we have the Mexican Revolution, and majority of Latter-day Saints fled back across the border. And in the 1920s, many migrated back to be part of the colonies. Among those were, you know, the purpose of this community was to perpetuate plural marriage. The church had ended the practice of plural marriage officially in 1890. We went through a period where in the colonies it continued to be perpetuated up to at least 1904. And it became really clear that the church, particularly after the revolution, did not support the continuation of plural marriage. So we had communities in Mexico that were associated with the church, Jesus Christ, the Latter-day Saints. And then we had members on the fringe of these communities who continued to perpetuate plural marriage. Most well-known among these communities is Colonia LeBaron. Colonia LeBaron was founded by Alma Dayer LeBaron, who was part of this early colony experience. He was ostracized by the local Latter-day Saint community, but his children founded a church. It was the Church of the Firstborn. And they believed that their colony in Colonia LeBaron was a place of refuge, a place that God had selected for them to perpetuate their religion. And so many of the communities we hear about in northern Mexico have loose ties or official ties with the sort of remnants of the Church of the Firstborn founded in the 1950s.
Right. When was the actual, for those who did flee to both Mexico and to Canada, in the 1880s and maybe even in the 1890s and maybe even shortly thereafter, when was their relationship actually severed with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints officially? Because I've seen pictures of some fundamentalist meeting houses where they will have pictures of the presidents of the church going right up to Joseph F. Smith.
This is great. That's a good point. So it depends on the group we're speaking of. There are, you know, several large polygamous communities that consider themselves a continuation of the church, and others that consider themselves a sort of a side group of the church. And so among these, they usually accept Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, John Taylor, and sometimes accept Wilford Woodruff, Lorenzo Snow, and Joseph F. Smith. The reason being, if you're supporting plural marriage, the first three prophets are very plural marriage is practiced and practiced in the open. Under Wilford Woodruff, the manifesto is issued. And then there's a period between Wilford Woodruff and Joseph F. Smith for these fundamentalist believers that it's a little murky. How much support did they give to these communities? Under Joseph F. Smith, it becomes very clear, particularly after the 19-teens, that if one perpetuates plural marriage, they'll be excommunicated and removed. These communities didn't form churches or organized groups until the 1920s and later.
Right. A question about the LeBaron family. I know and consider them friends, several people with the last name of LeBaron, one whom I worked with in Utah advertising for some time, that have some connections. Maybe the term would be not full tilt with at least what we associate with some of the LeBaron clan. As you look at the tragedy that so sadly unfolded in Mexico and the legacy of the LeBaron family, and we've certainly seen, I mean, we've had with this family and others, by the way, we've had some really tough stuff even up here in Utah that have resulted in shootouts, death, and everything else. And, you know, if you extend it on even into fundamentalism associated with the Lafferty's. As you heard about what unfolded in Mexico, maybe the fair question would be, were you surprised? Are there indicators that something like this, perhaps abrasiveness with neighbors, could happen? And neighbors, I'm using that term very loosely when you talk about a drug cartel.
That's right. You know, I think when I think of LeBarons and their history over the past 50 years, I don't think of a violent group. We have a group that's had several violent members, but the majority of LeBarons have never been violent. We've seen this really in 2009. We saw in Colonial LeBaron that people were organizing protection of their community and were trying to resist drug cartels. I don't think we think there's a really clear connection between those communities, except for distant relatives. So in short, I don't think this is a response to violence or strong-arming by LeBaron themselves. They're living in a dangerous area, and I think that's really what's going on here. I think it's geography rather than belief.
Do you have a moment to stay with us for one more quick segment? I'd like to talk about your upcoming book. If you can't, I completely understand.
Sure, I'd love to.
Okay, let's take a break, because I am curious about the book that Christopher Blythe has been working on that will, before too long, be published by Oxford. That's coming up here at KSL News Radio.
More afternoon news and in-depth coverage with Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
Well, I so appreciate Christopher Blythe joining us from BYU, from the Maxwell Institute. He spent a lot of time studying fundamentalist communities of the Church of Jesus Christ, or offshoots of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And he has a book coming up. And it's interesting, Christopher Blythe, how many of my friends, whom I cherish the relationship and they are great scholars, have published within, for example, Deseret Book, but they also often will publish with Oxford. Oxford seems to be particularly receptive, and that includes, I think, of Richard Turley. I think of so many people, the Mountain Meadow Massacre, the book simply called Massacre, many other books, one that I'm reading right now at home, published by Oxford. Is this a particularly open-arm, welcoming entity for Latter-day Saint scholarship?
You know, it's wonderful. Since Richard Turley's book, and before that when Terrell Givens first published with Oxford in the early 1990s, they've been really receptive to Latter-day Saint scholarship. Previously, you know, people were mainly publishing with places like University of Utah Press or
right.
University of Illinois. And it's neat to have an international press interested in the church and church scholarship.
Terrell's is the book that I'm reading right now that he wrote with my friend Brian, and it is really, really, first of all, it's one of those books that is making me think, and I have to keep my iPad right there so I can look things up, you know, and I love books like that, but it's
wonderful.
Yeah,
it's a great new book.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell us about your book that is coming up and when it will be out.
Oh, thank you. It's going to be out in July, and the topic looks at the way average members talked about the second coming and prophecy and the beginning of the church to the present. And so where did we get ideas like we should be careful in sharing visions and dreams and those sorts of things? And what's the way we portrayed what the end of the world we expected it to look like? Or the end of the United States will be expected when we were discussing it in the 1840s and 50s, and even in Mexico in the 1880s as a part of my book, to the present.
That's one of the reasons I wanted to bring the book up, because we were kind of tipped off that you were working on this, and maybe there would be some ties as to why families like the LeBarons and others have not only gone to Mexico, but stayed in Utah and to Mexico, and even to a certain degree maybe thrived in an environment. Is it more hospitable and so on? So I'm really looking forward to the book.
Well, I appreciate that. And that's right. This is Colonial LeBaron, when it was established, was based off of older prophecies that were shared. And you know, when we talk about these sorts of things, they're in the realm of folklore, so the church has always been unofficial when it comes to prophecies that are spread amongst church members. And one that has spread around quite a bit is called the Horseshoe Prophecy. And the Horseshoe Prophecy, the earliest time we've seen it was the 1880s, and later on we see it in the 1950s, right before Colonial LeBarons established and people began to move there. And the Horseshoe Prophecy is a story that the saints in Utah need to get back to Jackson County, but the way they're going to do it is in the shape of a horseshoe. They're going to go down to Mexico first and then come up to Jackson County. And this was very popular amongst the saints. In 1970, Harold B. Lee comes out and says, this is a prophecy we should not be spreading and sharing. But it did establish a lot of interest in Mexico in the 1880s, and again, Colonial LeBaron, the prophecy kind of lays the groundwork for the building of their community there.
Very interesting. You know, this conversation has given us some unique insights while everybody's trying to figure out, you know, what indeed did happen down there. You can't help but want to go upstream and find out why people are there and what were the motivating factors and what would inspire somebody to not only go there but to stay there and even stay in one of the roughest areas. This sadly did not lose the attention of the president of Mexico, didn't lose the attention of the president of the United States, because this is a dangerous and notorious area.
Absolutely. It's true.
I so appreciate you joining us today, and thank you for spending a little extra time. And as the nations, in this case the United States and, of course, Mexico, and with the ties that do lead right back here to the Wasatch Front in the state of Utah, we're all trying to sort this out. And this has been a most interesting conversation. I thank you for your time, and thank you for your efforts.
Thank you, Doug. Have a great day.
And the book will be out sometime in July. I'm very anxious to see that. All right. On that note, let's take just a brief break, and we've got a whole lot more. Let me give you a little heads up as to what is coming your way here on the program. Amelia Powers will be joining us, Amelia Powers Gardner, who is the Utah County Clerk and Auditor. We talked yesterday, and I've heard conversations even today with Sherry Swenson, who is the county clerk here along the Wasatch Front in Salt Lake County, about the voting. But apparently down in Utah County, there'll be something that will be available. And I'm not really 100% clear when this concept even came up, but it's available now, as I understand it. The app that allows, for example, disabled voters to vote without going through the traditional way has been used for those that have been offshore, people that have been serving in the military, on missions, things like that, in the Peace Corps, whatever it might be. But now for the first time, it's being used for voters right in the backyards in the in Utah County. So we'll find out what that's all about. And then also, this is interesting, Michaela and Spencer Jackman will be joining us. Spencer graduated BYU at 17 through concurrent enrollment, and we understand that this is somewhat of a family tradition. We wanted to get the lowdown on that, and we're coming up, I believe, this weekend on the 30-year anniversary of the falling of the Berlin Wall. And boy, many of us who are baby boomers, we watched that thing go up. We watched the terror, honestly, that surrounded it. We watched American presidents and other allies around the world calling for it to come down. And then finally, 30 years ago, it did. We'll review a little bit of the history of the Berlin Wall coming up on today's program here at KSL News Radio. Thanks for being part of the show.